hoping you get lots of food for thought on that topic. Rate, rate. I'll get your name there, please.
Good morning, everybody. Lovely to see you. What an introduction. I now have to embody mindfulness. You and I have habits, don't we? We won't talk about many of them here. But the habits that perhaps we will spend some time thinking about are what I call habits of conversation. So we all tend to speak up about certain things, and we find it easier to speak up about certain things. And we kind of find other things quite tricky to bring up, and we might silence ourselves on other topics. And then we also have habits around who we listen to, who we kind of prick our ears up at and kind of go, oh, must listen. And then others who we tend to discount. So these habits of conversation, habits of speaking up and habits of listening up matter. They have huge consequences on individuals and huge consequences inside organisations as well. So there's some consequences of conversational habits. There are some organisations where habits mean that it's not okay to speak up about certain things. And that has meant that a number of these organisations have been on the front cover of the newspaper for the wrong reasons. In a survey, part of the research that we're doing, and many thanks to some of you that filled in that survey, we know that from about 4,000 people that we've asked so far, about 8% of those currently know something that will harm their organisation if it was found out. And those 8% have not said anything about it yet. So there's implications and costs for individuals and for organisations. Some of the other organisations up there, they have habits whereby people stick up their hand and they say, I've got an idea. Or they say, I don't think we're doing this as well as we could do. And they get listened to. So habits of conversation are incredibly important for innovation and ideas as well. And of course, they're really, really important within the coaching relationship. And whilst I talk to you about the research today, which has involved about, we've done about over 200 interviews now, ethnographic studies, cooperative inquiry, first person action research, for those of you that care and know what some of those terms mean, bear perhaps two situations in mind. So the first one is obviously in your coaching relationship itself. So maybe bring to mind now a couple of the coaching relationships that you have and hold that question. What sort of habits of conversation do we have? What is it easy and comfortable to talk about? And perhaps what's less comfortable, feels a bit to talk about? And what do you tune into? You know, when your coachee is talking about something, which are the bits that you prick up your ears at and go, oh, you know, no, that's interesting. I'm going to look at that bit. Yeah? And which bits do we not listen in or tune into quite so much? So the research is quite relevant to our coaching relationships, but it's also relevant, obviously, in our coachee's work and non-work life as well. So some of the questions, you know, when does your coachee speak up and what do they stay silent about? And perhaps some of you at the moment are in coaching relationships where you have somebody knowing something or wanting to say something, wanting to speak up with feedback or ideas or challenge or something, and they're wondering how to do that. Who do they listen to and whose voices do they not hear? Whose voices do they not talk about in their coaching challenges? And then how might changing their habits serve them and serve others around them? Okay, so maybe just hold in mind a couple of examples whilst we go through this. So in the research, which has been a project that's run over 3 to 4 years now, Just a few overarching messages. The first thing that we really focus on and point out is that speaking up, which is a massively hot topic at the moment, certainly a lot of the clients that I'm working with have introduced a kind of cultural pillar called speak up or something like that. There's a lot of emphasis on individual courage. You know, let's help, they need to speak up. Let's send them on a workshop around courageous conversations. Tell them to be brave, and then they should do it. And I get quite a lot of leadership teams usually knock on my door, and they say, Megan, you know, we've told them to speak up, and they're not speaking up. You know, they're just not stepping up. They're just not taking responsibility. Go and sort them out, please. So off I go to they, and they say, you know, the last time somebody spoke up, they disappeared. Or, yes, we have tried speaking up a lot, and nothing ever happens. Yeah. So this speaking up focus, yes, the individual bravery, really important, but listening up is as important, perhaps more important. Yeah. So how are people inviting inside our organisational systems, how are people inviting people to speak up? What happens when they do? Does it persuade them to do it again? So seeing speaking up as a relational and systemic situation, an issue, rather than this kind of individual perspective. And what we notice is that this listening up is what we call a deaf spot rather than a blind spot. Yeah, we don't tend to think about the importance of how we're listening up. And as I'll say in a little while, we tend to think that we're quite good at this. And I have to say, as coaches particularly, you know, we've been trained ad infinitum on asking good questions, inviting people to speak up and listening well, haven't we? I mean, that's the kind of core foundation of it. So we can tend to think, well, you know, I'm wonderfully approachable, open, skilled at asking questions, but it still tends to be a bit of a blind spot. How do we listen? What do we tune into? We tend to think that we're slightly better at this than other people as well. So in the survey that we've run, and this was the same for the, we had about just about 20 people respond to the survey here. I think that's mainly because it could only be people who were employed inside organisations. But in that group as well, there was a kind of perception that it would be really helpful if other people were better at this. Fortunately, you know, we're okay. We're quite good, but, you know, we better just kind of wait until other people improve. And that is ubiquitous across all the research that we've done. People tend to put the issue out there. The final thing I will say is that when you're thinking about speaking up and listening up habits, you have to engage in the fascinating question of how do we construct power, status, and authority. So again, in our coaching relationship, how are we feeling in terms of status and authority? How is our coachee? How do they perceive power? Is it even in awareness? But it will be, it may be unconscious, but we are determining all the time, you know, what's our relative status here and authority? And they are determining that in their work relationships as well. It is fundamental in terms of their choices then around, do I have the status to speak up with this? Will I be okay or not? Had I better stay silent? Or do they have the status and authority for me to listen to, or perhaps could I discount them? So that power is absolutely vital to talk about. Do we talk about it in organisations? Hardly ever. Yeah. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. So in our research, I'm from a business school, Astrid Holt. So obviously we have a mnemonic that we came up with. So this is called the Truth Framework. It's not meant to be exhaustive, but it's meant to point to some of the things that affect the choices that we make every day and every moment in our coaching relationships around why and when do we speak up and why and how and when do we listen up. So I'll just take you through these really quickly and see whether they resonate in some of the relationships that you're working in at the moment. So T is for trust. So I won't speak up unless I feel I have a genuine contribution to make. So when I'm listening to my coachee and in my mind I'm going, maybe should I point this out? I feel this, but is that correct? All of this stuff, do I feel confident enough in my own sense of the situation to speak up or not? If I don't, I will probably stay silent. And in terms of listening, do I trust in the value of their opinion? And we tend to think that we trust people's opinions, but there's some people that we trust a little bit more than others. And again, I'll say a little bit more about that in a while. So that's trust. Risk. So I decide to speak up. I'm thinking, no, I've definitely got something to say here. What's going to happen if I say it? That's our very next thing that kind of tends to happen in our head. What are the consequences? What will happen when I say this? And we've interviewed a number of whistleblowers who face enormous risks when they're considering speaking up, and they're very aware of it. Sometimes they're grossly exaggerated, the risks, but actually, unfortunately, many times they're not. And we've spoken to people that have faced tragic consequences as a result of speaking up about something. But actually, more mundanely, and this was the case for those of you that completed the survey as well as our overall group, two risks that stop us speaking up: the risk of being perceived negatively and the risk of upsetting the other person. And, you know, I'm coaching an individual who is one of those guys, you know, when we were talking about hopes around coaching and expectations, it kind of comes out with the, like, well, my expectation is that you will, you know, lead me to some great insights here, you know, some huge insights. And that's his expectation as a result of coaching. And sometimes that's in my head when I'm about to speak up. It's like, the risk is I might be perceived as a crap coach. Oh my God, that would be awful. Yeah? So we're often thinking about these perceptions. And in the end, we're social animals, aren't we? Yeah, we want to belong. We want to be liked. Your coachee wants to belong and be liked. And so we're very, very sensitive around the risks of how we might be perceived and the risks of upsetting or angering the other person with what we say. So that's around the sort of speak up and the risks there. And stories are absolutely fundamental here. So I flippantly said that story about if you speak up, you disappear. That was actually a story in one of the organizations we did an ethnographic study with. That was the phrase they used. You speak up, you disappear. When I dug into it, 7 years ago, with a different chief executive, somebody did stick up their hand, challenged the chief executive in a group situation, and indeed, they were not there the following week. Nobody had ever asked the question about whether this person had actually already resigned and therefore felt completely capable to say whatever they liked, or indeed whether they left for other reasons. But in people's minds, it's like, that's the risk, that's the consequence. And if in our organisations we want to change the way people speak up, one of the things we have to change is the stories that circulate around the consequences of doing that. Yeah. One very interesting finding in our survey is in terms of listening up, we need to appreciate that other people might find it risky to say something to us. And I'm going to say a bit more about that because we tend to, as I've mentioned before, we tend to think that we're quite lovely and not at all scary, but actually some people might find us a bit intimidating. So do we appreciate other people find it risky to speak up to us. And what we see in our findings are that the more senior you get, the more optimistic stroke deluded we become that other people are speaking up. I think that's fascinating. So we get promoted, we start thinking, no, people speak up around here. No, it's pretty good. No, I have open meetings. Actually, you can pretty much guarantee as you get more senior, you are further and further away from the truth, which I find fascinating. So it's always worth challenging people that sort of naturally think that people are being open to them. Then U, this is the slightly forced bit of the mnemonic. U is for understanding politics. So if you speak up or if you listen up, those are political acts. They affect status and they are affected by people's agendas. And so, again, I wouldn't be surprised if a number of you are working with individuals who are having to navigate politics and how they speak up and the implications of how they speak up. And I sometimes call it the rules of the game inside organisations. What are the rules of what can be said and what can't be? And how can you kind of manoeuvre within those rules, potentially challenge them, but without being spat out of the system altogether because you're not playing? Yeah. So what's our understanding of rules? And one example I often refer to is a chief operating officer of a big bank who talked a lot about politics in relation to the LIBOR scandal and the financial crash. And he said, the problem at this organisation all starts with the biggest lie. And he said, the biggest lie? Budgets. He said, as soon as the word budget is mentioned, the lying begins. And he was referring to, you know, there's a political way of speaking up and listening up in that process. And if you don't know about it, it can be pretty dangerous. And I bet a number of you are also involved in coaching relationships where an individual is in the midst of a restructure as well, yeah? Because everybody's in the midst of a restructure. So at times of restructuring, very often organisations and leadership teams want people to speak up. You know, yeah, tell us what you think. And everybody's sitting there going, not a chance. I don't know who's in charge. I have no idea of the power dynamics or structure. What are the implications of me saying this? So until you tell me who's in charge of what, I'm going to stay silent. So again, another political context and situation that we need to sort of unpick and work with. This is one of my favourites. Titles and labels. And some of you may have heard me talk a bit about this. And, you know, when I come up on stage today, some of you may know me already, but you'll still have done this, and you're still doing it. You're putting labels on me. Yeah, you're labelling me. I was given some wonderful titles and labels. I was a kind of professor. I embody mindfulness. I all these things, you know. So that's label. Okay, and I stand up here. You've labelled me female. You've labelled me white. British, a number of other things. Age, we won't go there. But all of these labels affect your understanding and your judgment of my relative status and authority and whether I'm worth listening to or not. And this is a natural human process, thankfully, because we have to discern, don't we? And we have to stay safe. So we place titles and labels on people in order to help us figure out whether we should listen to them or whether we're okay to speak up in those situations. So some of the work that I'm doing at the moment in the coaching relationship and with organisational teams is to ask them, what titles count round here? What means you get the right to say something or not? What means you get heard or not? And it changes in different contexts. So one thing that I'll often refer to is the title HR. and I work with two particular clients at the moment where the label of HR means entirely different things. You know, in one context, it's pretty low status. It's kind of recruitment redundancy, basically, administrative. And the person in HR that I'm working with is really having to try and change the story around that label. And over here, HR, well, for one thing, has been rebadged people and has a completely different context. And the person I'm working with gets heard because people in HR are right at the centre of their organisation. So it's a really important question to ask, is what assumptions do we make around the titles and labels that we're using with one another? And I ask in the survey, I ask whether race, gender, job title or age affect how you listen to someone else. So just think about that for a second. Do you think that race, gender, job title, age affects how you listen to your coachee, for example? Now, in the overall survey of 4,000 people, about 90% of people say that race and gender never or rarely affects how they listen to other people. That's good, then. With the group here, it was about 70% said that it never or rarely affects how they listen. Job title, in the big group, about 60% say that that would never, never or rarely affect how they listen. In the smaller group here, it was about 40%. And age, you know, about 77% of people say that age never or rarely affects how they listen. In the group here, that was reduced, it was about 60%. So in the group here, as I'd expect, I think there's a little bit more kind of awareness that of unconscious bias, because we may not want any of these things to affect how we listen, and they do, almost certainly. And some of that is unconscious. So we're better off asking, actually, in what ways do they? And in what labels do I bias with? And they're different for all of us in different contexts. And engage with the fact that they do, so what do we do with that, rather than pretending that they don't exist, even if we really, really don't want them to. So that's titles. And of course, by the way, title of coach, executive coach. Executive coach. You know, what does that convey to your coaches? What does that convey in your organisation if you work internally? Internal coach. What does that mean for people? And again, for some people, you know, certainly you'll have worked in organisations as well where coach has a connotation of remedial, yeah? It kind of, that means you've done something wrong or you're about to be pushed out. In other organisations, absolutely not. It's like reward. But knowing the value, the power of these labels in the system and with the person that you're working with is really, really interesting and important. Because it will affect what they say to you. And the final thing, H, is around how to. So I want to speak up, I'm going to speak up. Do I have the skills to know why, what, when, how, who, with? And if I'm trying to listen up, and I think coaches, you know, again, we focus very much on this. How? What's the most skillful way we can manage to invite people to speak up? What is it that we do, the kind of questions that we frame? You know, I've come across managers that will show a presentation, a strategy presentation, and they'll show it to their team, click, 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 and then at the end they'll go, so, thoughts? And people go, yeah, great, you know. Or you can finish your strategy presentation and you can say, now, put yourself in the shoes of the most critical customer. Put yourself in the shoes of the most critical employee. Put yourselves in the shoes of the most critical supplier. What would they say? Ooh, you get a completely different conversation, don't you? So I kind of don't have to say that to this audience because you know the power of questions. But it's also environment, isn't it? Do you choose to meet your coachee in a in a little glass kind of box in their organization? Do you go for a walk? Do you sit on a sofa? Do you? All these things matter. What do you wear? What you wear matters and counts in terms of how relaxed perhaps another person might feel. One thing we found out from our survey is that formal meetings, you know, the life and soul, not the soul, the life and mechanical instrumental way that we run our businesses, meetings, happen to be the forum that we are at our most guarded. And that's where we're making most of our decisions. Let's bring everybody together in a room where they're not going to speak up and let's make a decision. So how do we, you know, knowing that for, and again, you've got the senior person that's convened the meeting that's happy as Larry because that was a successful meeting, they all agreed. Well, that's because nobody's speaking up. And anyway, you're deluded. You think they all agree, but they don't. So how can you really, really intelligently, skillfully, carefully, mindfully help voice to emerge? And of course, there is the other side. How do you skillfully, helpfully silence? Because at some point, you need to also silence. So that's the truth framework. I work with individuals and groups on just helping them figure out what does this field look like. If I'm trying to speak up, or if I really want to engage a certain group of people, let's just work through each of these points and see what we find out with it to raise awareness. And the other bit that I'm working with is traps that we fall into. So we've looked at speak up traps. So what are some of the things that get in the way of speaking up at all and speaking up skillfully? So one of those things you will definitely, I think, probably all have heard about, which is the imposter experience. So I'm sure, you know, many of you will be familiar with that here, and you'll be working with coachees who are lacking in confidence with their own voices. Now, I have interviewed quite a number of individuals that need more imposter voice. It would be really helpful if they had at least some doubt in their own opinion. Yes, and you've probably heard that, you know, if there is no whiff of an imposter voice at all, you're technically a psychopath. But most of us do have, obviously, this voice, this internal voice that goes, psst, when will they find out I don't know what I'm talking about? Yeah, when will they find out that somebody else could do this far better? When will they find out that they probably made a mistake when they promoted me? Yeah, this is the imposter voice. It's there to keep us safe. It's incredibly helpful, actually. But sometimes it gets a bit loud, and we take it as truth. So there's something about, can you spot the imposter voice? When it lurks up and goes, don't say anything, you're bound to look stupid. Can you kind of go, oh, hello, yeah, it's you again. And engage with this voice and say, well, hang on a second. Maybe I'll experiment here. Maybe I'll do something different. So that's the imposter voice. Second one, this is a, oh, cracky, this is a problem. We abdicate. We figure that somebody else will speak up or somebody else will do something. We're with an individual and a coachee and we're kind of thinking, I could give them this feedback, but maybe, you know, surely it's going to come out in their performance review. I mean, somebody's got to tell them. It might spoil my relationship, so hopefully somebody else will say it. So we abdicate. We think it's somebody else's job. And that can have dire consequences. I had quite a moving story from a senior clinician in the NHS who said, he came up to me and said that 30 years ago, he was a junior doctor with an individual that was a renowned bully, and nobody wanted to work with him. And he said, at the time, it did not even occur to him that he had any responsibility to give this person any feedback. And he said, in fact, at the time, all I really remember thinking is, brilliant, well done, I'm one of the few that can get on with him. And he said, it just didn't think about giving him feedback. 30 years later, he's a very senior guy, their paths had diverged, but 30 years later, he gets a formal complaint for bullying on his desk that he now needs to sort out, and it's about this guy 30 years later. And he sort of, you know, draws himself up and gets ready to give this feedback because now it's his job. And he goes in and he said, I gave him this feedback, and the guy bursts into tears. And rightly or wrongly says, nobody's sort of said that to me before. I didn't know. Now, I don't know, maybe he was, I don't know about that, but I wasn't aware of it. And this chap was going, you know, I wonder, 30 years ago, if I'd have had the resources to give him some feedback, it, you know, probably wouldn't have made any difference at all, don't know. But maybe, what if it had made some difference? You know, what if 30 years worth of colleagues have had to deal with this guy? Not to mention the fact that he's now about to lose his job, because nobody's ever given him that. And this is a huge issue, abdication. So we need to notice, again, it's that kind of voice that pops up in our head and says, no, not my job, or no, somebody else will do it. I'm sure it'll be fine. That's the voice we just, and again, we may be right. It may not be our job. Politically, it may be absolutely ridiculous for us to give the feedback. But we do need to just question that assumption because it's very easy to abdicate. Final one, I call it we talk to ourselves. And this is particularly prevalent in cross-cultural communication. So we talk in a way that suits us. And it suits our language and our mannerisms without putting ourselves into the shoes of the person that we're speaking to and talking in a way that they can hear. So again, cross-cultural is quite interesting here, and it is a total stereotype, but it is true that I was at a conference in Amsterdam, and a Dutch guy said, he was laughing, he said, I've just finished a stint in the UK leading a UK team, and he'd gone over, and in his first meeting, he'd done the, you know, this is the strategy, and then he'd said, pretty much, thoughts? And apparently the team had kind of looked at him and gone, interesting. And he said it took him quite a while to realise that interesting just didn't mean interesting. Because it did in Holland, you know, if you say it's interesting, that's what it means. It doesn't necessarily mean that in the UK. Another example is I spoke to an OD consultant, a really good OD consultant, who was talking to the leadership about a transformation. And he sat with the finance director and kind of tried to sell to him some of the change and transformation processes. And the FD sort of sat there and listened for about 5 minutes before he just said, we are struggling with a £6 million deficit here. I have to clear it in 6 months. What do you have to say about that? So in other words, don't talk to me unless you put it in my language. Speak to my issues, not something that you're passionate about. So do that. So we need to, you know, see the other points of view permanently, constantly. You know, even if we're trained to do this brilliantly well, we still have to remember to kind of go, hang on, what does the world look like from their shoes? And as a coach, how do I need to speak in a way that they really get and can hear? And then listening up traps. Some of you may have seen a little TEDx that I've done on this subject. So if you have seen that, I'll apologies about the duplication, but the first trap when we listen up to people is we forget how scary we are. And I reckon this is quite common with coaches, because we regard ourselves as lovely, and challenging and all that stuff, but approachable, you can confide in me, and we really mean that, and we believe that in ourselves, and we may sometimes forget that out of our control is the fact that they've labelled us with a number of other things that mean that we're intimidating, yeah. And particularly at the beginning of relationships, if people have been, sent to see a coach, we could be regarded as really quite scary. But because in ourselves we feel like we're lovely, we forget that. And I had a situation a while back where somebody said it took them... She wrote me a message and she said, it's taken me 3 days to press send on this because you're a professor. And I thought, you might not want to hear from me. And I'm like, what? I'm just so not scary. She's like, Okay. So we need to remember that some of these labels that we get put on us mean that we're quite scary. Even if as a coach you happen to know the chief executive and you know that your stuff is completely confidential, but people are kind of going, oh, scary. Yeah, so why might they be intimidated by you? Who might be intimidated by you? This chief operating officer, who in fact I coach as well, he had a good example of this. He said he went on, he walked the floors. That phrase, senior leaders, you need to walk the floor, get out of your office. Okay. They wander around the office. He was wandering around the trading floor and giving these lovely comments, supportive ideas. And it took him quite a while to realise that he was creating chaos because everybody was going, I think he means that he wants us to do this. And off they went and then scurried around trying to do the work because he forgot that he was quite scary. He forgot that people would take his comments like that. We need to empathise with how others feel about us. Then we don't question our little list. So we interviewed a chief executive who said that diversity really mattered and that ideas really counted from other people. And then he paused and said, but I do have my little list of the people that fit and the people that don't. And we all have a little list, okay? We all have a little list of whose voice counts more than others. And we have to do that because we have to discern. But do we check the list? We do need to rattle and shake the list and make sure why do we tune into them and not them? Yeah. Final one, we send shut up signals rather than speak up signals. And an example I often use is that, when I run a workshop or a conference, I look around the audience. And there's always some faces in the audience that are like this. And they're like exuding, like, go, Megan, go. And then there's some other faces that are like. And there was a workshop at Ashridge a couple of months ago when somebody was sat right in front of me. And I was saying my first sentence, which was, hello, my name's Megan. At which point this guy started eye-rolling, like this. And the workshop was 2 hours long. There was a lot of eye-rolling that was going on. And at the end of the workshop, he comes up to me and says, really interesting, where can I find out more? And it's just, Nancy Klein, you may know Nancy Klein, yeah. So her phrase, know your face. Do you know what your face is doing right now? Yeah? Because small movements... Okay, I can see all of you suddenly go... so what does your coachee look like, when you coach them? Do they know? Have they got the ability to understand what their face looks like? Just finally, these are some of the tips from some of those traps I mentioned. And some of you may be aware that part of my work is also in mindfulness. So my research now from here is really focused on how can we spot habits that I've been talking about? How can we spot them in the moment that they're happening? What we call meta-awareness. How can we spot them so we go, oh, I'm just about to do what I always do? Because with that awareness, we then have choice to do something slightly different. But without that awareness, we can't do anything. So both mindfulness practice and certain action inquiry and supervision can enable us to spot more in the moment the kind of habits that we have and then open up choice. And very often that's what we're trying to do for our coachee as well. How can they spot a pattern when they're doing it? And if it's an unhelpful pattern, how might they experiment with something else? But it's really tricky to change these habits. So just in summary, you know, speaking up and listening up, they're organisational imperatives and they're also personal imperatives. They're hugely important in our coaching relationships. They define our coaching relationships. Remembering that speaking up is relational. So if somebody's not speaking up, it's not usually just a matter about them having more courage. What can we do from our side relationally to improve the way and invite them to speak up? Changing habits is really tricky. But we have to disrupt this sort of automatic pilot. And there are some things that we know help. And that, watch this space, because that's where my research is heading this year, and probably longer than that, it's probably my life, actually. I'll probably be looking at that for life. So just in summary, if you're interested in the topic, speak up is, you'll get some flyers, I think. Oh, they've arrived. So we'll hand out some flyers. There's a book with Financial Times Publishing. I'm rubbish at this bit, doing this bit. It's out in about 2 weeks, I think. So that's available on pre-order, and it's basically all our research looks at both speaking up and listening up and the truth framework in quite a lot of detail. This thing is a TEDx talk which focuses on the listening up traps. There's a number of articles in Harvard Business Review. You might be interested, or some of your coachees might, you know, it's got the right label, hasn't it? HBR, it's got to be fine. So you can use those if the labels matter. And some of my mindfulness work is published last year with Michael Chaskelson in that book as well. So I hope I've just inspired some thoughts about some current coaching relationships, not only in your coaching relationship, but in your coachee's life and work. What are their habits of conversation and how might it serve them and others if they might experiment and alter some of those habits a little bit? Thank you ever so much. Thank you. One question, up to you. Oh, I should just say, if...